Blog Talk Radio.
Tell me the truth. Are you not mesmerized? Are chills not going up and down your skinny little spine?
What do you do all day? Not a goddamn thing. When was the last thing you did anything over there, that studio? Never. You never do a goddamn thing but sit around and bitch about women's genitalia. You guys are disgusting and need to get off the radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, the Jake Pentland Show. I am Jake Pentland, joined with my dear friend, Jen. Say hello.
Hello, Jake.
And Eli. Say hello.
Hello, Jake.
Well, most people are probably tuning in for the first time to hear our interview with Rosie O'Donnell. I pre-recorded it on Valentine's Day, and I don't want to waste too much time. I want to get right into it. But I just have to get one thing off my chest. Jen and Eli and I always do this show together, but I wanted to make Rosie feel as comfortable as possible because I do different kind of interviews than other people. I'm not really interested in career and all that. You all know that about Rosie. What I'm interested in is what makes someone tick. Sometimes I'm interested in psychology, and I wanted Rosie to feel comfortable, so I asked both Jen and Eli to not talk. I've said a shout-out to a couple of my listeners, and I felt really bad when the interview was over. I never gave Jen, I never gave you the credit you deserve. And I know you were upset, even though you won't admit it. So I just want to say that thank you very much for all your tireless effort and work, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. Are you done being a big psycho bitch now? We're good?
I wasn't a psycho bitch.
You were a little upset. I will delete. I will send the tweets out and text that you sent me. But anyway, I just want you to know that you know, I appreciate it. And I want to thank everybody, Elfboy as well, who helped me with the research. And let's not waste any more time. Here it is.
People say they want to be famous as if it's a attainable goal and a destination. And it's kind of neither. You know,
right.
I mean, you know, it reminds me most of, like, you climb to the top of Mount Everest and you get there, and it's a huge accomplishment, and not that many people have done it. So what do you have to do? You have to put your flag there and get down slowly without dying, and that's what I think fame's like, you know.
I like that.
Get back to Earth where, you know, and when you're up there, it's hard to breathe, your brain doesn't get enough oxygen, you don't make the best decisions. It's best not to hang out there if you can avoid it, right? Come back down to the earth.
I absolutely agree, because the main thing that changes when you have fame, it's not the money, it's the way people treat you. That's the thing people don't understand. And, yeah, why they're nice to you, it's completely surfacey. It's complete, you know, kiss-ass, and they all want something. They don't want to help you out of kindness. They want you to give them something back. So all of a sudden, all of humanity, instant, in that very instant you become famous, becomes leeches. You're like in a pond full of leeches. Even the nicest, well-intended people still want that brush. They want that spotlight from you. They want to
right.
see you in your
shadow. And when you're the person they want to brush against or interact with, you know, it becomes exhausting and taxing and an unfulfillable fallacy. No one can be what every single person has them representing in the narrative of their own life to that person when they actually interact. So I just came back from Babies R Us today, right? And I was there with my ponytail and my menopause getting my baby formula stuff. And people are coming over. It's a variety of things from, I'm so glad that you didn't die when you had your heart attack, to, are you still friends with John Goodman? Which I tell your mother that happens to me at least once a day. You know, oh my God, Roseanne, I get that at least once a day. And, or the third thing is, you know, listen, I don't want to ask you, but my mother is cancer. Could you possibly, listen, I don't want to bother you, but I heard you wanted to buy Honey Boo Boo a house. My kid lost their house. This is what I get, like, and my Twitter, after a while, felt a little bit like a Craigslist, you know, what they needed, what people needed, right? And it becomes very taxing, you know, and I was cast in a role or, you know, the me that was most known on a daily basis on my show was quite affable, you know? I mean, I'm a very kind of likable on that show. I was quite likable, and even that was tiring, you know.
Are you saying you're not likable in real life?
I'm saying I'm not only likable. You know, I remember when the queen of nice. I thought, oh, this is going to kick me, bite me in the ass. And I even said it on the show live. I said, you know what this is going to be in 5 years? The queen of fried rice. The queen of life. It's all bad. Get ready, people. Because, you know, I've been around enough. Every wave hits the shore. Nobody gets out unscathed, you know. As much as you're adored, you're going to be loathed. And that's the truth, you know. Unless you're Julie Andrews, I think, who's adored constantly.
Yeah, everyone loves her. Well, I have noticed you, I wouldn't want to say maybe more than anyone, but you have your fair share of abuse, certainly on Twitter. I don't know if you know, last week we did a Twitty of the Week with that woman that told you to stop posting pictures of your kid because you're gay and shouldn't have children.
Yeah. I was sure that was a guy. It was a woman?
Oh, I don't know, actually. That shows my sexism. I assumed it was a... I don't even know why I thought it was a woman. I think the name... who knows? They're a Twitty. That's all I know. But
what they were, yes.
You represent... I mean, politically, your decisions in your life, you're pretty much like in the center of every major hot-button issue in this country. I don't know if you've ever considered that.
Yeah, just by living, but that's okay. You know,
yeah, but I mean, like, you know, you have gay adoption, you've been gay marriage. I mean, you name it, everything that sort of rips this country apart, you're in the middle, and that's probably also an additional level of exhaustion,
right, gun
I would
control,
imagine.
You know. Every time, like, gun control happens or anything, you know, involving, like, the Newton shooting, everyone goes back to Columbine, to me taking, you know, on the NRA in my own deluded way. And, you know, so then I get called, or my publicist gets called, or Twittered or something. What do I feel about this or that? And you know, I don't know. It's always surprising to me that a casual comment can make news, but it has.
Well, they've sort of made you a poster child for the site that they don't like. I mean, you sort of...
Yeah. And that's
no matter
okay.
what you say.
You know, everybody has in their mind the good guys and the bad guys, and I can tell, you know, where I fall in the movie that they're watching, right? I'm either a hero to some, and
right.
I'm, you know, some sort of a leader, or I'm a horrible, fat, unpatriotic, you know, left-wing loser. And
that must be why you get mixed up with my mother all the time. It's pretty much the same thing with her.
Well, listen, you know, I have to say that she is somebody that I admire and have since the beginning of both of our careers. And I remember people saying to me, oh, my God, aren't you upset? There's a heavyset comedian named Roseanne, and she has a hit show. And I was just doing stand-up at the time, you know, and I was like, no, because if she makes it, she kicks down the door. That makes it easier for me to make it. Like, I never felt that competitive thing amongst women or amongst comics that I saw a lot with the men. But I never felt that myself in my own, you know, feminist upbringing. You know, I had a teacher. My mom died when I was 10, and there was a teacher in school who sort of took me under her wing. And she was like an ardent feminist, you know. So I grew up with Our Bodies, Ourselves and Gloria Steinem as a Hero and Ms. Magazine. And I'm like, you know, the first child of feminism, right?
Right.
And, you know, so to me, your mother is everything I would aspire to be.
Well, on that note, because that is my favorite topic, feminism, everyone's really worried that I was going to be mean to you, which I find hysterical, first of all. I'm a huge fan of yours.
Well, why would they think that?
Well, you know, I'm opinionated, and I have, you know, here's the thing, a little bit about me. I know this is your interview, but I love talking about myself because I'm a narcissist.
Well, I actually so enjoyed you on the Roseanne's Nuts show. I thought you were adorable and fun,
well,
and that you and your mom had a great relationship, and I thought you came off really well. Like, as a mom... looking, you know, I thought I'd be proud of that kid.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that was me on the show, and I'm the same on the radio. I don't know what happened, where the confusion was, but I think when my mom started yelling at me and my sisters called into that show, I think everyone just assumed I was the angry, crazy one when I was, you know, pretty middle of the road. So my stance on feminism was not that, you know, feminists are idiots or anything like that. I was just saying that it seems that it's a lot now about tearing men down, and I'm a proud man. I think men are awesome, and that, I think, is what really upset my mother.
Yeah, I don't think it's so much about tearing men down now. I think at the start of the feminist movement in the 70s, in the early 70s, it was much more about that, much more separatist. I felt that, you know, even the heterosexual feminists were, you know, like, it seemed a betrayal when Gloria Steinem got married. People were like, what? You know, and she didn't get married until she was older. And what is she doing to us? I think it was much more separatist back in the very beginning. But I do agree and worry that the feminist movement has sort of lost its center for a while. I think it's coming back now. But there was a time where, you know, women were not proud to call themselves feminists, that they somehow thought it took on a negative connotation, you know, in the, I think, 70s and 80s. It was a proud thing to say, and then it became sort of out of fashion, you know. And
yeah.
I think it's something that everyone, that it'd be crazy to me that a woman wouldn't be a feminist. I don't get it, you know.
I understand that. And again, for the record, I'm for, you know, equal pay for equal work. You know, right to vote. There's not a part of me that's in depression at all, and I don't know why I've been painted that way. I'll ask you a question, see if you react as angry as my mother. I have thrown
all
this
right
out there to her that women in America, the United States, and I'm not talking about the Middle East or Afghanistan, but women in the large part of the United States are not dealing with oppression today. That made
her
very mad.
Well, that's not true at all.
Okay,
well, that's
so you
totally
would disagree.
Untrue. Well, that's only because you're a man, and you'll never be able to know that, you know, because you're not a woman. But if you're a woman, you're in danger sexually every time you walk outside your front door, or sadly, you know, sometimes inside your own house. I mean, if you're a woman, you're in danger. I mean, I think that you'll never be able to get that.
Well, I mean, when you say that, that doesn't mean that there's, like, a legislation that makes rape legal. I mean, yeah, there's certain dangers, but it's not an oppressive society.
Well, I think it is. It's oppressive in that, it, you know, where women are overtly over-sexualized, children are becoming really sexualized. They still don't have, you know, equality. We still don't have, you know, basic equality to men in so many areas. I mean, you know, you're a smart kid, and it's funny to me. It's like, you know, your mother's an ardent feminist, so somehow you've gotten painted as, you know, an anti-feminist. And it makes me laugh because, you know, my kid, what am I always against? War, guns, what does he do? He's at a military academy.
Right.
Right. Of his own volition. I think when you have a strong mother, like you do, and like my oldest boy does, you have to kind of rebel against them in some way. And it's hard also to separate because from what I have known of your mom, I bet that when she does focus in and love, it's like getting microwaved, right? That she's not maybe old available to do that, but she does kind of, doesn't she have a microwave kind of laser love?
Yes, that's fair to say.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, from my... I don't know, I'm not her kid, and you can never know, you know. In my fantasy life of what Roseanne is as a mom, and from what I've seen of how she reacts with all you guys on the TV show and with Buck when he was little, you know, she loves kids. She was
she
a
does.
Housewife, and with children raising them happily in Utah or that place, you could. You know, so she loves kids, and I think that if you love your kids, it's hard for the oldest boy to... define himself in the shadow of such a large, physically and, you know, taking up presence-wise, mother like me and her, you know.
Well, just to, you know, to be clear, I'm trying not to make this all about myself, but I am totally, which is so sad. I hate myself.
Which is okay. I get it.
My mother is sexist. I don't know that you are, but she absolutely is. I mean, it's not so much to say women are oppressed like you would say, which is a reasonable argument. We can have that all day. She goes as far as to say men are idiots, all men are stupid. That was the sort of issue I had, which I found funny when I did the radio show saying that, you know, I'm for equality and we're all in this together, and then I was called a stupid man who's a sexist. I found that really funny, and then I literally got fired. So... That's my perspective, which is why people think you have such an odd perspective. Well, that's my reality. And,
yeah.
And again,
well,
you're...
you know, in the same way that, you know, I maybe go overboard on the areas that I go overboard, that's, you know, one of the ways that is part of her shtick. It's part of her outlook on life. It's part of her perspective. It's a part of her history. It's part of, you know, how she makes comedy.
And that's the thing. I mean, you know, we all are a collection of our experiences. You are a comedian, and... for me, being on the inside, I have yet to meet a comedian that didn't come from some sort of trauma or pain as a child. I mean, I'm not the first person to say this, and my mother's the first person that will admit it. She had an abusive childhood. We don't have to get into specifics. But there is a certain thing that comes from comedians I've noticed. They seem to have, I don't know, more pain in their childhood than others. I think everyone
I think that's definitely true. That's from what I've experienced, really true. And, you know, so when something happens, like Rich Jenny shoots himself in the head, you know, as much as everybody, you know, all the other comedians are like, oh, my God, that's horrible. Nobody goes, how did that happen?
Right.
Right? Nobody goes, I didn't see that coming. Right? If a comedian, you know, takes their life or does something tragic, people go, yeah, Kenneth and Wally, he was fucked up. But prior, the guy was a genius. But, oh, whoa, you know, some people don't survive, right? The addiction
right.
and the craziness and the insanity and how you prioritize and manage and deal with all of those issues is really what determines what your life is, right? So, I mean, everybody's had it. Every comic I know, you're right, has had a horrible childhood.
And so humor is probably just a way to survive, something you develop.
Yeah, I think it's a huge shell. It's like armor, you know. And when we were kids, we couldn't talk about the reality at dinner of what we were feeling, let's say maybe to have no mother or dirty clothes at school or, you know, but you could make a joke about, you know, about that. Or, you know, maybe I got teased at school. They called me greaser because I didn't wash my hair because my mom had died. Nobody told us to take a shower every day, you know, whatever. I didn't wash a lot. And I would, you know, could make a joke about them calling me greaser at dinner. But when they called me greaser, it hurt me. So when they called me a name, you know, but I ended up becoming funnier than them and quicker than them and able to sort of, you know, put them in their place. And then eventually, I don't know, things turned around. But I definitely think it's armor. It's a protective shield.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I don't want to say this for you, but my mother's even mentioned her weight was armor, too.
It still is. Mine, too, yes. It's mine, too, totally. And, you know, you can do everything. You can get your stomach cut. You can, you know, pay somebody to sit in your house and make you work out 8 hours a day. You can, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's another addiction. How do you deal with stress? Food? You want to disguise parts of your body. You don't want to be sexually available, sexually vulnerable. You want to make yourself, you know, kind of not appealing because you don't want the advances of people besides the ones you want. It's very complicated, and so I always laugh when people, you know, have the newest book about how you're going to lose weight and how you're going to do it, and I'm like, I know, but it has nothing to do with the book, you know.
Right, and obviously they haven't had the experiences that you or my mother had. I mean, I don't know your personal experiences, but I mean, I can guess. But whenever I see people that are much more vain and happy and looking good and want those advances, I imagine they probably had a different upbringing than you did.
Yeah, but not, you know, I mean, I will say this. When I see a woman who's heavy, very heavy, I always think to myself, what happened to you?
Mm-hmm.
Right? When I look at them just even today at the store, I'm like, I don't know what happened to her. You know, that's the first thing I think. I don't necessarily think it with heavy men. Maybe I should, but I don't. But with women, I definitely think that. Now, does that mean that every overweight or obese woman has been abused? I don't know, but I think a vast majority has. You know, they did studies in psych wards. Like, the percentage of women in psych wards who were raped or molested is, like, you know, absurd, like 80% or something. You know, and I don't know. I think it has a profound effect on the way you view your body and what pleasure it can give you or what pain it can cause you.
And in your experience, I mean, you have 5 children, is that correct?
Yeah.
So you have 5 children. You're an adult now, obviously. I mean, it seems like you've come a long way from whatever trauma you had as a child. You seem to be functioning well, but I doubt, you know, no one's perfect. Nobody gets out of here alive. That's what I always say. And we all go on our deathbed. But still, even if we work our whole lives, there's still going to be a little bit of, you know, PTSD, so to speak.
Exactly.
I mean, it seems like you're cognizant with your children not to pass any of that stuff on. But, I mean,
I'm sure I will, because, no, you know, listen, everyone becomes an adult having survived a horrific childhood, right? And the horror is only through your own perspective. So, you know, when your mom says to you on the phone, you don't know what it's like to really work. You don't know what it's like. You know, she thought she was doing you a favor by, you know, providing you with things, and you end up being spoiled and acting entitled. And, well, she didn't have things as a kid. She wants her kids to have things. It's a very, so I'm leaving them damaged, believe me. I don't want it. I fess up to where I fuck up. You know, it's not like I'm, but believe me, they're not, you know, it's no dream having me as a mom. I keep thinking of the titles of the books. I'm like, you know, how about this, Parker? Life with Mom Wasn't Always Rosy. That's good. Come on. You know, he's like, I'm not writing a book. I just read it. Shirley MacLaine wrote a book about her mother. Shirley MacLaine's daughter wrote a book about her.
Oh,
and I read that book that, yeah, oh gosh, I was right. I read the book the day it came out, and, you know, I know Shirley MacLaine in a sort of superficial celebrity way, right? But I don't know her enough to, like, call her up. But I read this book, and I was so defensive for Shirley MacLaine. as if, you know, my children were writing it. You know, like I'm saying, I'm sure she was busy when she forgot to pick you up at boarding school. I'm sure she was doing a big movie. Maybe she was with Anne Bancroft and that, you know. Like, I'm defending the celebrity's, you know, malice or perceived indifference from the child, because I know that someday I, too, will sit in that seat where my kids will go, here are the ways you failed me, you know.
Right.
And I'll go, all right, I hope you can forgive me.
I always think that's what adulthood is when you start reading those books or watching movies. The minute you go from empathizing with the child to the parent, that's when I think,
yes,
that's what I think the 30s is. That's been happening to me the last few years. I used to be so protective of the way kids were viewed, and everything they said was perfect. And now I'm getting a little bit older. I don't have kids, but I'm starting to sort of empathize with the parent a little bit. Like, those things that used to piss me off that parents would say when I was a kid, like, there's no handbook for how to raise you properly.
Right.
You know, they all have that stuff, and you're like, whatever, what a cop-out, you shitty parent. But then you get older, and you're like, fuck, man, I'm human. I'm as fucked up as the rest of us, and now I'm going to be...
Wait until you have a child, Jake.
Well, that's why I don't.
Wait until you will. You have...
Well, we'll see. I think I have to have sex with my wife.
Well, you have to have sex with your wife, too, but that's a whole other issue. But, you know, you will have a baby, because that's really what life is about in many ways. And then I'm not saying if you don't have a kid, your life is no value, but... You know, you want to get the most out of life. You want to have the most intimate connections you can have, and the most intimate connection with another human is to parent them. And it's the most beautiful and terrifying. You're so vulnerable to your children's, you know, thoughts and needs, and you know, it's a pretty intense relationship, and I think nobody should get out of life without trying it.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, The Cult of Jake, which I don't know if you've seen or caught words of that with Twitter or whatnot, but that's the movement. I mean, that's what I feel like. If everybody, even if you have kids or not, but if your goal every morning you wake up and your goal is to overcome whatever bullshit you have inside, whatever, you know, dysfunction you have, so that you can be a better person, if your goal is to do that so that you can be a better parent, or, like you mentioned, your teacher sort of after your mother died taking over, you can parent kids without being their parent. But I always say, the world could be fixed in one generation if everybody right now fixed themselves first with the sole intent purpose of being a better role model to children, because then you have a generation of children that aren't fucked up like us. You've worked out your issues. You're making them better. And then those children will grow up and they'll be in charge of shit and they'll be better suited than any of us were. It seems like that you could fix 90% of the issues if you did that. That's my
belief. I think that...
I know it's simple, but...
I think it's a great kind of fantasy, you know, that people could somehow in one lifetime come to terms with everything that they've lived through and live kind of a peaceful, then like Russell Brand existence. You know, I do think meditation helps that a lot. I do think slowing down your life and taking time to care and nurture yourself. You know, I had a heart attack in August, and... you know, I remember talking to the doctor and her saying, this is what I want you to do, and this is how I need you to take care of yourself. And so here it is, February, and I've lost maybe 11 pounds. I should lose at least 50 by now, but I've lost 11. And about a week ago, I went to Dunkin' Donuts and had 2 donuts. And, you know, there are days when I can't walk past a little candy store on the street without physically, you know, moving myself. Like, there are times when my addiction to food is so intense that, you know, it overtakes my ability to, you know, I wake up every morning thinking I'm going to deal with it. I wake up every morning, my goal is to be healthier. I try very hard, but, you know, you're going to hurt other people's feelings. You're going to, you can't live, there's no Martha Stewartville where people just all,
well, she's an asshole, for the record. She's a huge asshole.
Well,
I know
there's
a lot.
There's a perfection image that she, you know, puts out there. Yeah. And she, and it's, you know, some people can live like that. I always thought she had mild Asperger's. She's very good with social relationships, but she's very meticulous on details of wrapping, you know?
Well, see, you always say when you look at someone who's heavy set, what happened to them? When I see someone who's famous, that's what I think. What happened to them? So instantly, Martha Stewart, I've researched her childhood. That's one of my hobbies. And she's a mess. I mean, it makes sense. She comes from...
Now, I think I think it's a fascinating story. She was one of six children, and she grew up in Nutley, New Jersey, in a one-bathroom house for six kids and two parents.
Mm-hmm. So she's probably
that's
mild
tough.
OCD. No, I know. That's the thing. When she finally got her own space, she probably was so meticulous because she's had cleaning her brother and sister's pubic hair out of the sink every night, and she probably got her own space, and then she became... I mean, that's like essentially we're saying the same thing. So for you personally, having five kids, how far do you think you're along, honestly, in your journey from the 10-year-old girl who wasn't showering to the mother of five now, honestly?
Not that far. I mean, you know, I feel like that little girl a lot, and that's, you know, not a good thing. Anytime I feel afraid or, you know, I feel all of those issues of abandonment, of my mother dying, of no one taking care of me, of not having enough, of, you know, I don't have enough. I mean, it's taken me so long to, like, stop over-ordering clothes and stuff. And I never close shopping in the store. I don't really like shopping. It's not like I'm buying expensive things. Like, I'll think I need another 10 black T-shirts, right?
Right.
Plain old black T-shirts and in size 3X, which I'm not. You know, I'm like a 1X. But still, like, I overbuy them too big. I buy too many. So am I far from that child I was? No. But, you know, do I think I'm a good mother? I think I was a great mother until they turned into teenagers. And I never had a mother during my teenage years. And I never reacted the way a normal teen did because I didn't have a mother to rebel against. So I wanted
had,
to love and appreciate.
You had your father after your mother died. He raised you from what I can find. It was very hard to find information on you because I also saw someone
yes.
who took custody of your siblings. So I'm not really sure. But he was alive after your mother died, right?
Yeah, he's still alive.
Oh, okay.
He lives in Florida. And nobody really sees him too much. And I heard from him after I had my heart attack. He sent me a little letter. And,
okay,
you know,
so you
listen, he had a horrible childhood. I could tell you that right now.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he tried to do better for us than it happened to him. And in many ways he did, and in some ways he didn't. So, you know, every generation you hopefully move the chain up, you know, a little bit. So you get to higher branch of the tree and a greater perspective. That's the goal, I think, for each generation. So, you know, he's around. He's alive. And he's never met my kids, and he probably never will. And, you know, and I think he has a lot of pain in his life that he never got help for. You know, sad,
yeah.
Really. Really yeah. Sad.
It's
but,
very sad.
You know, when my kids, my father was there, but he wasn't really there. You know, I mean, he was there in the house. My grandmother was there as well, too, my mother's mother. But she was, you know, very large and had diabetes and couldn't really see and couldn't, you know, really care for herself that well. And she would sit at the kitchen table kind of sideways, smoking a Chesterfield unfiltered cigarette and pulling one piece of tobacco off her tongue. And but she was always there, and the presence of someone there when you came home from school was so, so important. So, you know, even after my mom died, my grandmother was still there, you know. And, yeah, she sort of emotionally, I guess, raised us. But, you know, my dad, not so much.
Not an emotional guy, or was he just kind of...
No,
quiet?
Just really, no, violent? Not really, no.
No,
no,
quiet.
No, he was calm. In fact, people, you know, people often, he looks just like John Mahoney, the actor.
I don't know who that is.
Who was on Friends, do you know him?
Mm-mm.
He played Frasier's dad on Friends.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, he looks just like him. You know, so he's like a frail guy, kind of, and he's an old guy, And I saw him once right after Kelly and I got separated. I saw him for the first time in like 20 years at my brother's house. And it was so weird. The first thing I said to him is, God, you're old. If you don't see somebody in that long, you know, you have the image of them from the last time you saw them. I was like, holy crap, you know.
Yeah. I
and
know.
It changes it.
We were estranged from my grandparents. Sometime I was 12 till I think 20. Four, I didn't speak to that whole side of my mother's family.
I remember
we had
that.
a family reunion in my mother's home up in Lake Arrowhead. She had this big house, and I was so nervous. And of course, I don't want to get into too many specifics, but the story sort of morphed over the years. So it was like I these people were so vilified to me; they were just hideous monsters.
Yeah.
And then I hear, "Oh no, it's not so bad. We're going up there to spend the weekend with them." So I was very guarded, and that was the weirdest weekend of my life, but that was one of the first things I said to my grandmother, too. I was like, my God, you're old. That's,
yeah.
All that pain and trauma, what came out of both our mouths.
Do you remember them? Because you were 12, right?
The first time? Well, yeah. My mother and father divorced when I was 11, and then my dad was close with his in-laws, my mother's family, and Tom wasn't. And Tom was the ultimate wedge driver. I mean, he sort of weaseled his fat cokehead in there pretty quick, and they were gone. They were gone within 6-7 months, I believe, of when Mom married Tom. So, yeah, it was I know what it's like to have an estranged family member. I mean, we get along great now. I'm very fortunate. But you can't.
Now, you remembered them, though. So, you know, it's interesting because my daughter, who's 15, often says she'd like to meet him, you know. And I'm like, really? You know, why is that? And I don't know. She has, like, whatever her reasons are. But I think, well, wouldn't that be weird to, like, introduce him to, here's somebody who's not in my life because it's not really healthy for me, and now I'd like you to be, you know, introduced. I don't know. It feels like it's the wrong thing to do.
I mean, I can understand your side, but I can also understand hers. I missed the years with my grandparents and my grandfather. He died before we reconnected, so the last time I saw him was like, hey, see you next week, and then I never saw him again. He had his problems, I'll be honest. But I think, like you said, I'm lucky that I do remember him. I do have memories with him. I do have pictures where we're together. But I imagine if I never knew him, I doubt your daughter has ever met your father. I think I would want to meet him. I think that's natural. I mean, it's her grandfather.
Yeah.
It's her paternal grandfather. And she's not, you know, she's objective on it for right and wrong reasons. And she doesn't feel your history or your pain. She's just like, why can't I meet my grandfather? I can see her side. I mean, I kind of get it.
Yeah, I can too. And also I think, you know, adopted children, they have such a need to claim the family that they have through adoption and sometimes their birth family as well. And I get it. You know, I often say to my children, you know, when you're 21 or 18, if you want to look for your birth parents, like, tell me and I'll help you. Because I get it. Like, I get it. Like, so I think that's, the good part is that I do understand, like, where my daughter's coming from. It's not like I have a totalitarian regime where I say, you know, no, you're not allowed to feel that.
Right. But there's probably a little trepidation. I mean, you don't want him around your kids for obvious reasons. So she should sort of at least see a red flag there, you would think. I see a red flag. You know
what
I mean?
I think she knows the reasons why I don't see him. And I don't know. She just, you know. She was like, am I ever going to get to meet him? I'm like, I don't think so, honey. I don't think so. You know? And I feel sad for him. His wife died. He got remarried when I was about 20-something, and she recently died. And, you know, my older brother went to the funeral, and then he called me and said, are you going to go to the funeral? I'm like, but I haven't seen her. I saw her once in the last 20 years. I don't want to, you know. Do you go to the funeral? If you're estranged and somebody dies in your family, do you? You know, when my father dies, do I go to the funeral when I haven't seen? Like, it's a strange kind of position to be in.
Yeah, totally understandable. I'm lucky our family made up because that was one of those things I wouldn't have gone. You know, and it's a weird choice that most people don't understand.
Your mom, even though a lot of the things that she did that were public and that affected you not only personally but probably publicly as well, you know, also provided tremendous solace to other people, like including me. When I was working on a lot of my, you know, stuff with my childhood and abuse and whatnot, and she had come out that she had been abused, and I know that in hindsight and later she said maybe that wasn't what happened or whatever, but when she actually said it, you know, until she really said it, people didn't talk about it that much. I really do credit her with, you know, and it woke up something in me. I remember I saw her at a restaurant, a few months after that, and I went over to her and said, you know, the same thing happened to me when I was a kid. And she said, really? And I said, yeah. Now, I hadn't even really talked about it to my therapist. And so I said to my therapist, you know, it's so weird. I saw Roseanne Barr at a restaurant, and I told her that I was abused too. And the therapist said, oh, really? Well,
she never mentioned
that. I had never said it to the therapist, but the therapist said she had been waiting for years for me to say it, right?
Oh, so
she
knew.
Waiting for me to say it. Right, she knew. And, but your mother saying it, I said to my shrink, I lied to Roseanne Barr. I told her I was abused, and I wasn't. But that's how she helped people. She was brave enough to face it and to show you can survive with facing it. And it encouraged other people, either unconsciously, subconsciously, to explore themselves and be brave enough to face what's hidden in the locked door, you know, in your psyche. So, I mean, I know it couldn't have been easy, and there were things that I'm sure, you know, you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy in terms of what you had to go through because of the fame. But on the other hand, you know, there were tremendous benefits that you received, and I always say to my kids, glass half empty or half full.
Right.
Yes, I get it. It's a pain in the ass, but look what we got from it.
I guess always the thing that always makes me sad is not that, you know, somebody was abused or that, you know, I mean, that's sad, but the scary thing for me is that they are going to start lumping shame and denial and those kinds of things over the years that if you, even if you're 7 or 8 and you don't understand it, let's say you're physically or sexually abused by whoever, you know, obviously you're going to shut down, but it's those years afterwards where, you know, you're have addictions or you're eating too much or you're doing drugs or whatever, that's where the battle's fought. You can't change what happened when you were a child. You weren't able to defend yourself. You were tiny. And I always think about in my mom's case or yours or whose ever, it's like you can't undo what was done. You can't change it, but you're an adult. You can defend yourself. You don't have to go about the same routines and patterns of self-protection. You don't have to.
And that's what you say every day when you wake up. And so some ways you do much better, you know, and some ways, you know, well, I'm not a drug addict. I'm not an alcoholic. Right, but
right.
I'm fat. I know. Not so different, right? It's
is
not
that
so
why you
different,
eat?
But
when you say you can't pass
well,
a bunch of them, is there?
I think it's a lot to do with why, you know, listen, you look at all my siblings, we all have the same O'Donnell body.
Right.
That big old Jackie Gleason stomach. You know, the whole point of diabetes stomach and, you know, and thin legs. And, I mean, we all have the same kind of physique or profile. But, you know, could I treat myself better so that I would not look quite so big? Yes, I could, you know.
Right, but that's not the priority. You're doing it for protection.
Well, obviously the need to have it remains, right? Or
right.
I would let it go. So
right.
What I do is I pray the need for it goes away, right? When I do my meditation, that's I don't think that, you know, I hope I stay on my diet today. I hope my need to overeat today does not win. I hope that I can lose, you know, the desire. You know, I was at the hair place yesterday getting my very gray hair dyed, and this woman was talking to me, and one of the men who worked there was so unbelievably buff, like his muscles, and I said, look at that guy. And she said, oh, yeah, he likes to go to the gym every day. And I said, I wish I liked to go to the gym. Why can't I like to go to the gym? I don't like to go to the gym.
He's probably armoring in a different way.
Exactly. Who knows? Maybe he does crystal meth. Maybe he's like, but, you know. No,
or maybe he's healthy.
Right. Like, or look at my wife, Michelle, when I met her. Like, you know, I was kind of like stunned and I have to say judgmental. Like, I never really thought that people look sort of like the aesthetic perfect that America has told you is beautiful really had anything of value to offer in the world. I never, like, thought of them as possible mates. I sort of ignored their existence. Like,
me too.
You know, people were just shockingly stunning. And really, I gave them no validity at all. And so then to actually come to know, and I said, well, I was prejudiced against you people. I didn't realize it, but I really was, you know. But I said to her, too, imagine what it's like for me, where I sit to look at you, somebody who understood what the aesthetic values were and then achieved them.
Yeah, it's impressive.
It's shocking. It's impressive.
I'm with you, too. In fact, I find myself sometimes justifying their existence. I mean, I'm not too heavy, but I'm probably about 20, 30 pounds overweight. And my excuses of why I'm there are hysterical. If I'm ever objective enough with myself and think, just listen to the way you fucking bullshit your way out of this. They're so cheesy, and that's one of the things. I have now convinced myself and tried to convince my wife, who wants me to lose a few pounds, that anyone that's in shape or healthy is obviously really screwed up.
Right, exactly.
Which only about a week ago did that hit me, the sheer insanity of that, which is, for me, I had to get in touch with why I tend to overeat, which I do. And, again, we're not in therapy together, so we don't have to get too intense here, but I figured it out. We'll just say that. And I've already lost about 8 pounds in the last week and a half, and I didn't really change my behavior necessarily. I realized that the reasons behind what I was doing, the sort of physical manifestations, had a source. And in that, if more people could do that, you could really change a lot of things about yourself that you don't like or that you're not pleased with. But it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it is hard. You know, it sounds a little Scientology, you know, like that you can sort of find the answer and then fix that answer and then everything will be okay.
Right.
Like, I find that life's more material than that, and emotions and feelings and being, you know, incarnate as we, you know, walk around the planet, these little souls that we are, trying to figure out how to work this human body while we're figuring out our lessons of evolution, right?
Right.
I don't know. I feel like it would be nice to know that if you could figure it out, okay, I understand, I had abuse issues, I don't trust people, I food to comfort, I had no mother cooking for us, we had, you know, okay, I got it, you know. But still, even having a heart attack, Jake, And I'm like, how much closer do you have to come? Michelle said to the nurse, you know, how is she doing compared to other people who had what she had? And the nurse said, she's doing excellent. And my wife said, well, how can you be sure? She goes, well, because all the other people are dead.
I mean, how much of the heart attack was physical and how much do you think maybe was psychological? I mean, I know the mind has power over the body that few people understand. My grandfather had about 7 heart attacks. He was very, very troubled. He would pull over. He got so many heart attacks, he knew when he would have a heart attack, and he would pull the car over and have a cigarette to calm himself before he went to the hospital. It was like second nature to him. And he lived a high-stress life. I mean, it wasn't just eating. It wasn't just genetic, I don't think. I think, you know, a lot of it was just that he was constantly under stress. And I wonder if that has any influence on you and your heart.
Yeah, I totally think it does. And you know, Michelle had been very, very sick since the spring. And I'd been in the hospital, like, you know, many, many nights, like over 50 days or something. And they didn't know what she had. And she had these tumors in her stomach. And they didn't. It was very traumatic. And I've never really went through anything like that before in my life, and it was unbelievably unnerving. And we were stuck in San Francisco where we didn't know anyone because she was too sick to fly for like 10 days. So it was, I was very much alone, and I was very much, I was terrified. And, you know, so as soon as she got well, I got sick. Like, you know, 10 days after she was fine and up and about, I had a heart attack. Now, also, after my heart attack, they did an MRI, and they said there was very, very minimal damage. And there's a thing for women called heartbreak syndrome, where these doctors are studying where women who've been through some emotionally taxing ordeal, whether it's seeing a child, you know, hit by a car and or a spouse dying or some emotional turbulence, that have a real heart attack. But the way they know it's not the same as another real heart attack is because there's hardly any damage.
Right?
Like it reads the EKG, heart attack, stent needed, 100% blocked on the LAD, definitely heart attack. And so then, you know, a month later, they do it and see how much damage you have, and they're like, there's none. None. And I was like, that's very weird. And so they're entering my case in that study that they're doing with this heartbreak syndrome because they want to see how much emotion and stress can affect your body physically. And I think it can totally, like, completely affect it.
So you are still in therapy? No?
Every week with a wonderful woman named Peg, who said to me, I think you're mine for life. I'm like, well, it's a little sad, but okay.
Yeah, long-term investment.
I guess. But she's very helpful. I really, you know, I go for 2 hours, and I actually look forward to it. And I find it very grounding, and I'm very, very happy to have her in my life. I've had some amazing therapists, but this woman has been, you know, for the last 5 years or 6 years, and has been very helpful.
Her technique is probably similar to mine, which is, you
which
know,
is.
Deal with the source, always, I would hope. I hope she talks that way.
Yes.
Okay.
She does. You know, but, you know, what does that remind you of, or what do you think that's related to? Or, you know, and I always can come back and you know, and if I don't, sometimes, like, I always feel like it's being on a game show. She's like, well, I said something earlier. I said, I did. Yeah, think about what you said that's similar to that. Well, what did I say? You know, I get like, wait, what? Did I miss it? Did I miss the little nugget of wisdom that I'm supposed to ingest?
I wanted to be a therapist, but I was too lazy to, you know, because I'm a spoiled rich kid, to actually go through college. So when I started doing radio, I started paying attention to my interview style, and I was like, oh, my God, I'm a fucking failed therapist. That's pretty much what I am. That's how I approach interviews. But I think it works. Because, again, people might be...
Well, that's what I like to do, too. I like to find out who the person is and what makes them that way.
Yeah, because we both know. I mean, here's the truth. Being famous everyone outside probably thinks you know something, or you've figured out some nugget of trivia, or that you're better or perfect, and you're the same asshole the rest of us are, and they don't get that. And I think that's the weirder part about fame, and I want to ask this, one of my final questions is, sure, you have people that want something from you, exhausting, but that weird thing where people look at you like you're better than you really are, that you have some nugget of wisdom that they don't understand, that is something that, you know, some of us might think, oh, that'd be cool. Really think about that for all you people listening that aren't famous. That's terrifying, because now everyone is looking at you for something that you're not, and that can crack you psychologically every day, because you're sitting here putting out a projection of yourself. You're being honest. You're having personal relationships, and yet everybody sort of ignores what you say and do, and they lump you in this weird projection they've made up in their own head. It's, and you have to either live up to it or constantly dissatisfy them that you're not.
Well, you rub up against it all the time, whether or not you just rub up against it, no matter what it is that they perceive you as, you know, by virtue of your fame. But I will say this, I like it a lot better now in terms of how I'm kind of able to move in public as more of a normal person. And even though I know I'm famous and I'll always probably be known, but it's nowhere near what it was. And you know, Carrie Fisher had a great play that she wrote about her family. It was on Broadway recently, and she said, you know, fame is nothing but waiting for obscurity. And it's true that, you know, there was a time where I couldn't go out anywhere without every single person knowing in my name. And now sometimes I walk in and I'll say, can I have a table for four, please? And they'll say, name, you know, and I like smile and say, Rosie. And then they go, oh, I thought it was you. You know, or how's John Goodman? You know, one
of the two. I just had a plumber come to the studio here. I work at my mother's studio, and I had to have a plumber come fix. And he was asking what I did, and I told him, and who the boss was, and blah blah blah. And he asked me if my mother had been the same since coming out of the closet.
See. So you did
go,
the same.
Are you talking about Rosie O'Donnell? He goes, yeah. Did people get you two mixed up? I was going to do a game with you and Mom, but I decided against it, and I didn't really figure it out. But people confuse you two all the time.
Oh my God!
It's hysterical.
You have no idea. When I was in the hospital, this Hispanic orderly guy who, like, you know, wheeled me out after they put the stent in, and he said, "Miss Rosie, can I ask you something?" I said, "Yes." Do you think the stress of that roast on TV gave you this heart attack? Because it was like 2 days after the Roseanne roast aired, right?
Right.
That I had the heart attack, and so he was convinced that that was the reason that the roast gave me the heart attack.
It's so weird, but it's really not that different than fame. I mean, you're constantly confused with someone that you're not anyway. I guess you kind of get used to it.
Yeah. And most people are nice. You know, truthfully, Jake, most people come over, they only say nice things. They say, you know, you helped me come out to my family. You know, I used to watch you with my mom, and she's no longer. You know, most people are very, very kind. And truthfully, to get to affect that many people in that kind of way is a beautiful thing. You know, I had a friend who once told me, and she said, it's like your job is the flower delivery girl, because, you know, she said she delivered flowers, and every time that somebody opened their door, they smiled at her because they saw her holding these flowers. She said it was the best job because I got all these smiles. She said, hanging around with you, it's like you're the flower delivery girl. Every time that someone recognizes you, they smile, you know? And I'm like, and that's a huge sort of warm, kind of unimaginably meaningful thing.
And you are very active in charities. I saw even so that you were, I think it was your, I think she was your fiancé at the time, saying you were addicted to Kickstarter. I saw that in some interview.
Yeah,
you're doing that all day. But you do, you really do put a lot of good back out there. I mean, it's amazing. You have foundations. If you want to mention any of them, feel free to.
Yeah, I have a bunch, and the Rosie's Broadway Kids is a wonderful school you had for 10 years for the poorest kids in New York to really not only get an education in the arts, but to get help with counseling and then college applications and high schools. And, you know, so we have a school, and it's a beautiful, wonderful tribute to all the teachers who helped me, and I love that I have that. And you know, I've been really lucky. I mean, I did much better than I ever dreamed I could have done in the show business. And to give back, I think, was always the reason I wanted to be famous to begin with, because I knew at 10 when they told me that my mother was going to die, that if it was Barbara Streisand's mother, you know, she'd go on the Johnny Carson show, and she'd ask everyone to send $1, and then they'd get $1,000, and then they'd get the good medicine. So even as a young child of 10, I knew there was power in fame,
to be used for social good. And that was the reason that I wanted it. It wasn't that I wanted to be in a magazine or wanted to be the perfect, you know, size two. I mean, if anything, you know, the women I wanted to be like were always, you know, Vivian Vance or Eve Arden or Kay Ballard or, you know, the sidekick, the funny one. And it was your mom who made the sidekick the star.
Yeah,
it was
true.
Your mom. You know, good usually point. The Fat Funny Friend is not, you know, it's Rhoda. It was the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but Rhoda didn't get her own show till she was skinny. But your
right.
mom, you know, was the only woman who was the lead like that, you know, and it changed everything.
It did.
It really
you continue
did.
To. If you could go back right now, in one of your meditations, and talk to little Rosie, what would you say to her? It's one of my favorite questions somebody asked me once.
Yeah, I'd probably say don't be so afraid all the time. You know, I was afraid a lot as a kid. And it's funny because, you know, you do stand-up, people think, well, that's scary. Well, it's not scary at all. But I remember, like, you know, I was terrified every time it got dark. Even as a comic on the road, you know, I would come home really probably like 5 or 6 in the morning. I'd go out with the waitresses drinking, and then we'd go to Denny's, and I'd get back to the hotel at like 5 or 6 in the morning because it was getting light, and then I could sleep.
You couldn't sleep.
Right, for a while. Of the dark scared the hell out of me. So I would tell her not to be so afraid, you know. But I
like
think that's something that you only...
scared of the dark or
sorry?
Something deeper? Like a normal kids are afraid of the dark or was it deeper?
No, it was definitely deeper. I mean, I made Jackie, who's my best friend, her mom, they lived across the street. I made her watch me run across the street till I was like 16.
Jeez.
And we were like in suburban Comac, Long Island. It wasn't like, you know, there were any robberies or it was suburban bliss. But I was just, you know, inordinately afraid of, you know, because some bad things had happened in the night. You know, kids were molested in their homes. That's what happened. That's when it happens usually. And so the nights were scary to me. And so I was scared a lot. I would just tell her not to be so afraid. And then in the end, it's all going to work out. But I think I had ultimate faith it would work out because I kind of dreamed that I would be quite successful, you know? Like, I kind of knew it. And I would tell kids at school, I'm going to be on the Johnny Carson Show. I'm going to be rich and famous. They were like, you're what? Like, no, I am. Like, I was certain, you know? And when kids say to me now, do you think I should continue to try to be an actress? Or I said, well, you think you're going to make it? Well, I don't know. Then you should quit.
Right.
Right? If somebody says to me, I am positive, and I go, okay, keep trying. And even of those people that are positive, I think probably only 1 out of 100 make it.
Right.
But you have to be positive. I was positive.
My mom tells me sometimes, and she said it on stage, so I can, it's not spilling secrets, but she talks about how she was visited by a spirit when she was younger that told her she was going to be famous. And she was so sure of it after that. But she saw something in the mirror. And now she's probably, who knows?
Yeah,
maybe she's
who
crazy.
Knows what it was. Well, you know, the line between genius and crazy has always been tenuous at best.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look at any person in history of the world, and there's always sort of a touch of what other people would say is crazy, and that's where genius lives. So,
yeah,
our little crazy is all right with me.
Well, I'm glad you can, you know, you're here now, and you have kids, and one of the things people were nervous about me bringing up with you was gay adoption. I did a show on with my gay uncle. My aunt and uncle are both gay. My aunt has two girls. They've both been married for almost 30 years each. Very stable relationships. But I brought up to my uncle that I felt the ideal situation is for a kid to have a healthy mother and father. And he flipped out at me like my mother did on the feminist thing. So I think that's why people were nervous. But for the record, you know, it doesn't matter if you're two women, two men. If you're loving a kid, it's a better circumstance for them than being an abusive home, and I think I just have to sort of clarify that for people. They're very nervous about me talking to you.
Oh, really? No,
yeah.
Listen, I mean, I would also be all right with people who say, who have a different view. I'm only okay to talk to people who have a different view. It's not like, unless you agree with me, I'm not going to, you know, answer your questions. But, you know, I think that what a child needs in love is, you know, consistency and kindness and stability and two adults giving that to one child is the optimum. And whether the gender of those adults is a viable component of the equation is something that we can argue about. But
yeah,
I don't think it is.
I mean, I don't know. Again, this is an ideal and, you know, perfect best case scenario. So, which was, I was only making that point for debate. But, you know, a lot of right wing people
say that, you know, the perfect is a mother, but well, half of the heterosexual marriages end in divorce.
Absolutely.
So how perfect is it? You know, so I don't know. I think that if a child has two loving parents, boy, are they lucky. And if they
or
have
even one loving parent,
that's enough
yeah.
to get them through. Exactly.
No, I just said the ideal was a healthy man and woman. And the reason I said that, not because of religious undertones. I'm a registered Democrat. I'm very progressive. I'm not. I've also been accused of being a right-wing nut job. It's just that as a boy, you know, it was very important to me to have a healthy male role model. I had that with my father. I was very lucky. Now, Tom wasn't, and there was a few in there that weren't. But I know that even two loving mothers having a son, there's going to be that need. Boys emulate men just like little girls emulate older women, and you can learn from both. It's not a gender thing. It's just I understand that, and
yeah,
that's
and
why
I
made
that
point.
I think that you have a right to say that.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I get it. Listen, to say, you know, there's not an issue where there's two moms and no dad around, that it's not a factor, that it's not, you know, something to be added into the mix. It is. And, you know, who knows the way it will end up affecting, you know, my children.
Right.
But that's what it is. You know, like
right.
I remember Parker was a little boy, like 5 years old, and he said to me on a beach, he was sitting with a bunch of other people that, you know, were also on the beach, and he came back and he said, you know, some people think two mommies can't be married. And I said, yeah, that's right. Some people do think that, but that's not true because you've got two mommies and they're married. He goes, yeah, but what if I'm one of those people? And I said, well, you know, you're allowed to think what you think, honey, but I will tell you this, that, you know, if you wouldn't be my son if because I'm the kind of mommy that wants another mommy. So in order for me to be your mommy, you wouldn't get to have a daddy. You'd have to have another mommy. So, you know, I understand what you're saying, but it wouldn't be me as your mommy.
Right.
And he said, well, I guess I'll just keep you. I said, well, thank you, sweetheart.
Pretty much
but,
my
you know,
philosophy.
I bring it up. I think that you're allowed to bring it up. You're allowed to see what are the ramifications of it, you know. Who knows?
Well, I mean, your son,
know,
Parker, he's in military school, and according to everything I read, he asked of it. I mean, you're, like you said, you're not necessarily pro-war, pro-military. He's
no,
in there.
I did. I actively did not want him to go there.
Right. And I think it's very cool that you let him go between you and me.
Right.
As a boy. Because
he really did want to, and he really, you know, he's thriving there, and he, you know, he may go to a military college, which we're seeing now, but, you know, you got to let kids find their bliss.
My question is, do you think that that's where he's going to get his, quote-unquote, positive male role model?
Perhaps.
Yeah,
you know?
I think that's what it is.
He's got uncles. We got friends. He's got uncles. He's got, you know, grandfather he's very close to, Kelly's father. But the company of men, I think, was appealing to him, having been raised in a house full of women, right, with no
well,
men
yeah.
around. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'd go so far as to say it's helpful. It's healthy for both genders to want to be around an adult version of their gender. I think
yeah.
that's the normal thing. I mean,
yeah,
I think it's so far as that it's instinct and it's ingrained. I mean, if every boy I ever knew without a dad, he was always looking and friendly with the older boys, and they were a lot of them are in gangs, and you know, with the older male role model, and that's something that I think is very, very deep in our core that we want that.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that
me
it's.
Too.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
For me too, as a kid, I always looked for moms. I looked
right.
for mothers everywhere, and lucky for me, I found them. You
right.
know, and with amazing women who took me, you know, in as a daughter and loved me and kept me safe. And you know, that's something that I think women never really get credit for, how much we mother other people's children. And I don't even mean the ones we adopt, you know,
right.
the neighbors who end up, you know, pitching in and being there, being that adult that's the consistent force in someone's life for good. And it changes people's whole world. I know it did mine, you know. But part of the reason I left Parker go to military school was because I thought that's what he was looking for, and I understood.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, people, when they were nervous about me interviewing, I couldn't understand, because that decision you made there to okay it already means you're more fit to parent than 95% of people in this country. I mean, the fact that you wouldn't put your own personal agenda on him and feel that that's what he's asking, and even question maybe there's some psychological thing there that I can't give him, and to be okay with it, that's what a good parent does. I would have no issue with you. I have no issue with you. I don't know why they were nervous.
I don't know who they are, but
Oh, no, they're a bunch of losers. They're a bunch of cat ladies and crazy people.
I thought to myself, God, if my son wanted to do a podcast or was doing a radio show and he wanted to call and ask one of my friends to do it, I would be, very touched and moved that, one of my friends would call. So like when you asked me to do this, I thought, oh, my God, that's her little boy.
Right.
That's her little boy. And as much as she could call and scream at you and tell you you're fired and you're an asshole and that you're her kid, honey. That's
yeah.
big.
It's great. And it's also very hard to book guests on the show, to be honest with you.
Really?
Because of that.
Why?
I think a lot of people assume, what's that?
Because of your mom?
No, I think most people assume I probably have some, red phone to every celebrity in town. And it's like, to get you on the show, I had to psycho stalk you on DM forever. I mean, I'm just saying it's crazy once a few weeks ago. I mean, you don't have to tell people what I said, but it's hard. And also, this is a podcast. It's not like I have a nationally syndicated radio station where you can come on and promote and a million people are going to listen. I mean, this is a podcast. Nobody listens.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to
build
it.
I wanted to do a podcast. After I did the Sirius Radio, which I really like doing, I wanted to do a podcast. But it's so hard to get it and then get people to, but I don't know what the delivery platform is going to be for all of this media that people are self-creating, because it's a whole new world out there.
Yeah.
And, people don't want to pay the subscription fee, but they do want the content. So what do? Put it up on YouTube, but then how do you monetize that? And so it's very complicated. It's like a whole new world and as far as entertainment. Like when your mom and I were doing it, it was like the last train out of town,
Right. I feel like
no
I'm
longer
old,
like that.
Like a wildcatter in the days of striking oil. It's a new, exciting frontier. This is what I want to do. This is my dream. This is not the hobby.
And who have you interviewed? You've interviewed like a bunch of celebrities?
Celebrity-wise, Sandra Bernhardt I did. That was a great show. Jenny Mullen, I don't know if you know, she's Jason Biggs' wife. She's fucking hysterical. I tried to have Eden Wood's mother on, who's this little pageant girl, like the Honey Boo Boo on TLC. She's a little less white trashy.
Right.
I thought she called in last week, but it was an impersonator. So that was, I don't know if I can take credit for that one or not, but
right.
It's been tough. It's been tough, but you keep talking about charity and Kickstarter. I got to say, doing my show is one of the kindest things anyone's ever done for me, and I mean that. And I'm not kissing your ass. You've really sort of, I don't want to say legitimized me because I'm still a fucking podcaster with no listeners, but this certainly
gives me.
Honey,
everyone starts somewhere.
Exactly.
Right?
Hey, in a year I got
and
you.
I think you're good at what you do. Look
Thank
at
you.
I mean, I remember you on the Macadamia Nut Show, as I called it, with the whole Roseanne's Nuts. You're very articulate. I thought you were so tender and kind with your mom. I loved that show. I thought of reality shows, that was one of the best, because
Thank
it showed
you.
A part of your mom that no one had seen and how it was produced. I thought it was really, really well done.
Well, thank you. I was a producer on that, so I'm going to take credit for
well,
that, too.
It really was. I mean, I worked with one of the guys from that crew, the blonde guy.
No, he's brilliant. Sean.
Yes, Sean. He was at the show I did on the Oprah Network, and
I
said to him, he said I worked on that show. I'm like, then you're hired, because we wanted to do a reality every Friday, I just loved it. I loved the little ukulele singing, and it felt really different take on celebrity reality show.
Yeah, that's what we were going for. Think Lifetime did a shitty job promoting it. I like to tell them every day.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Well,
and I think that they have to really believe in, what they're doing and sort of get behind and stick by you before,
everyone's got a podcast. But
right.
Not everyone gets Rosie O'Donnell, so I'm very, very pleased. And I have to read one little message before I let you go. It's from a really dear friend and listener of this show. Kathy is her name. And she begged me to tell you this, so I have to do it.
Okay.
Here it is. Her son was murdered years ago. And she wants me to tell you that your show got her through many nights. It was an escape for her, and for an hour every night, you gave her a place to escape, and for that she loves you and thanks you. Her name is Kathy Reynolds.
That's
she's on Twitter. Yeah, so that's got to be the upside of fame. And also Jeffrey, who does this show during the week, Unscripted Radio, got into radio for you, and he's begging me to invite you on during the week. It's the same blog talk.
You
can find him. What's that?
Are you on that show too?
I do the Saturday show for them. He's the one that put me on. After my mom fired me, he scooped me up and gave me a second chance. So he's a really good man. So I'm passing that invite on. And if you're comfortable with
all
me
right.
doing it, I'll I'll fill in. But anyway, I'm going to let you go. You gave up a lot of time. Happy Valentine's Day, by the way.
Thank you, and to you. And say hello to your mom and all your sisters and brothers. And I hope I get to talk to you again, Jake. You're doing good. Carry on, son.
Thank you so much.
All right.
All right. Bye.